Now back to 1987. In an attempt to win a posh radio prize, Nigel Molesworth presents his guide to cinema, theatre, painting and country dancing.
Molesworth, Episode 4, The Arts.
Hello, Nigel Molesworth with you again to offer some of the crumbs which have fallen from the richly laden table of my intellect. Not bad, that bit, was it? I am capable of some fairly classy writing, you know. Wasted on Radio 4. I always think of my natural habitat as Radio 3. I only mention this, actually, to alert those people out there who like the really artistic stuff, and to make it clear that I won't make a fuss if this little programme of mine is nominated for the Italia Conti Prize. But I digress. Where was I? Crumbs on the richly laden table of my intellect. And this week, the crumbs I offer are on the subject of the arts. Ugh. I'm afraid I always have that reaction to those words. I think probably, like most things, it goes back to my early days. Yes, back to St. Custard's. When it wasn't the arts, of course, there was only one of them. Art. Taken by Miss Pringle, who got lumbered with all the irrelevant things like art, music, country, dancing, yuck. Still, once we'd locked her in the paint cupboard in the art room, the lesson could be quite fun.
Lock the door, Molesworth!
Yaboo, sacks, clot face. Molesworth, you've got the face of a blue baboon. And if I ching this blue paint at you, you'll look even more like one.
If you do, Peace, and I will ching back this pot of red paint and your face's resemblance to a squished tomato will be even more uncanny.
Bet you daren't, Molesworth.
Oh, really? Well, I jolly well do dare, flea brain.
There! Okay, you've asked for it, banana features.
Right. This is war. Dip paintbrushes.
Paintbrush dip.
And on guard.
On guard.
Have at thee, Violet.
Really, Molesworth, Peason, please stop.
Never bothering some Thomas, that weed Peason has impugned my honour.
Molesworth, you mean impugned, not impugned.
Never mind, he's done it, whatever it's called. Gotcha! You weedy chick, take that!
Oh, please, I pray you to stop. See, you have splashed poster paint over my delicate watercolour.
Oh, hard cheese, Fotherington Thomas, what are you painting anyway?
See, it is these delicate flowers and grasses in this delicate vase. How pretty are the flowers. How pretty are the grasses. How pretty is the vase.
Oh, how pretty are Fotherington Thomas's golden locks.
Oh, thank you, Molesworth. I have always suspected that beneath your surly exterior there beats a heart that can be touched by beauty.
Ah, discovered. Cheers, curses.
And you too can respond with joy to the loveliness of the clouds and the sky.
Don't you believe it. Hey, Peason, don't you think Fotherington Thomas's golden locks look better with a few streaks of red?
Yes. How about a bit of blue?
Oh, no, you cruel boys. How callously you behave. And yet I forgive you.
Hey there, it's Grimes.
Blimey.
Yes, you odious worm guinea brand, it is Grimes. Except that you do not call me Grimes, do you, boy?
No, sir.
No, you call me sir to my face, and when talking about me, you call me headmaster, don't you, boy?
Yes, sir.
Right, Gillibrand, after school you were right out 3 trillion times, I must refer to the headmaster as the headmaster.
Sir.
And what other troublemakers have we here? And who might these multicoloured specimens of pond life be? Is it possible that here we see those notorious malefactors, Molesworth and Peason?
Well, sir, we...
Silence! Oh, and can this be Fotherington Thomas? Oh, dear me, how upset your dear mother would be to see her precious Basil in this state.
Yes, sir. And I pray that it may never happen, for it is my earnest wish never to cause grief to either my darling mummy or my sweet sister, Arabella.
Very commendable, Fotherington Thomas. So this is meant to be an art lesson, is it, Molesworth?
Yes, sir.
What do you know about art, Molesworth?
Well, sir, probably not a great deal, sir.
No, Molesworth, not a great deal. One of the many subjects about which you don't seem to know a great deal, Molesworth. Could you, for example, name me 3 famous Italian painters, Molesworth?
Dante, sir.
No, Molesworth.
Grotto, sir?
No, Molesworth.
Lasagna, sir.
No, Molesworth. Anyone else know?
Sir.
Peason? I don't know why I bothered asking.
Sir.
Gillibrand.
Sir!
Oh, very well, Fotherington Thomas.
Well, sir, if we start in the 13th century with Giotto, other significant names would be Cimabue, Toriti, Cavallini, Duccio de Buoninsegna, Simone Martini, Pietro Ambrogio, Lorenzetti, Francesco Traini, Lorenzo Monaco, Gentile Fabriani, Pisanello...
Yes, thank you, Fotherington Thomas. Exactly the answer I would have given myself. Right, Molesworth, let's try you on something else. What Molesworth is artistically the best painting in the world?
The Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci, sir.
No, you fool boy. The correct answer is The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. Idiot. Molesworth, after school, you will write out 3 trillion times, artistically the best painting in the world is The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. And think yourself lucky that you're not getting more punishment than that. Your appalling behaviour.
I don't know. I often think that kind of teaching coloured my whole attitude to art. And my attitude, I'm afraid, is a bit different from that of my spouse and helpmeet Louise. She has this awful idea that art ought to be a topic of conversation. I think Louise's ideal image of herself is as the leader of some kind of salon, a dazzling hostess at whose soirée the evenings coruscate with intellectual brilliance. Well, needless to say, there is one big obstacle to her realisation of this ambition. She's married to it. Yes, I'm afraid that sort of thing is just not my scene. I have made this point to her on numerous occasions, but does that stop her from involving me in her hideous attempts at intellectual gatherings? Does she accept my argument that everyone would be much happier all round if I spent the evening down at the Coach and Hounds having a few pints with Peason? Him, him, rhetorical questions both. You see, Louise reckons that if she assembles Lucinda's piano teacher, two pillars of the local amateur dramatic society, together with the film critic from the local paper, and gives them sufficient garlic and Algerian Bordeaux-style plonk from the local Grabo supermarket, then the evening will sparkle. She's clearly horribly wrong. But will she realise it? Another rhetorical question, actually.
No, but I mean, surely the whole issue of the tension between art and reality is in danger of becoming a cliché. I mean, quite honestly, is there any more to say on the subject after Sobolchev's masterful statement in the bread-cutting scene from Broken Husk?
Find Sobolchev a bit cinematically simplistic, actually.
Really? No, I wouldn't have said that.
Yes, I mean, almost cinematically glib. I mean, I would have thought the whole issue is dealt with far more tellingly and economically in that salami slicing scene in Pesto Lamiatelli's solo for three-handed trombone. Don't you agree, Louise?
Well, yes, and no. I feel that perhaps marginally more relevant is that 17-minute shot of the sparrow being plucked in Jean-François du Banister's Fricassee of a Young Girl's Heart.
I see your point, of course, but for me, the most startling contribution to the debate is the mud pie moment in Mbandango's Mbatani's Imbuguagare.
But that's so cinematically faux naive.
A bit cinematically heavy-handed, too.
Almost to the point of cinematic clumsiness.
I can only say that cinematically it works for me. Nigel, what do you think? Cinematically.
We were talking about films, Nigel.
Well, I like the bit when it cut off the Viet Cong prisoner's hand in Rambo 6.
That's the trouble, you see, particularly with films. Louise and I just have different priorities. Anyway, that art film mush is dead easy. Oh, I could direct something like that, if I bothered. It doesn't require much actual talent to be impenetrably obscure.
And this week on Location, we visit the northernmost tip of Sweden, and very nice too, where that unpredictable cinematic genius, Nigmar Molesworthson, is working on his latest masterpiece, Rose Petals on the Piston Wings.
No, no, Sven. You must hold the shot of the dead fish and the screwdriver for longer. Now, come on, let's rehearse the scene of Ingeborg on the bed. Of course, you stupid woman. Don't you understand the symbolism of the having the bed flirting in a vat of mandarin yogurt? No, of course not, you pea-brain. Well, just do it. Read the critics when the film comes out. They'll explain it. Kirsten! Ingeborg hasn't got enough sump oil over her breasts.
Oh,
right.
Katrin, let's have a look at the shirt.
Hello,
there's something missing. Olaf! Could you add a couple more disemboweled birdies over the back there? Otherwise, the critics may not realize the telling comment I am making on a regional scene. Now, can we get this shirt lined up? Come on. Good, it's Hurl being a genius. Let's get some work done. Action.
Skinkness, misnip, nip, 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 nip.
I don't know, though. I mean, as I say, I could do all that without too much problem. I'm not really sure that I'd want to. You see, my favourite artistic fantasies aren't of pretentious idiots like that, or of the kind of name-dropping twit Louise favours. Her, no. The intellectual Nigel Molesworth has considerably more style, wit, and elegance.
But surely, my dear Lord Counterpane, no woman ever suffered from an excess of beauty.
Beauty and excess, my dear Lady Eiderdown, go hand in hand. Beauty without excess is the coldness of a statue. Excess without beauty, the grossness of the libertine.
Indeed. What does that actually mean?
I don't know, but it sounds good.
But Lord Counterpane, who is that astonishingly beautiful youth who has just entered the room?
The young man who looks as if he were made of ivory and rose leaves.
The very same.
I must introduce you, Lady Eiderdown, to one of the finest wits of our generation. It is my young friend, Dorian Molesworth. Dorian.
Counterpane, my dear fellow.
I don't believe you've met Lady Eiderdown. Dorian Molesworth.
Enchanted.
Oh, so am I, so am I.
The pleasure of meeting a new acquaintance can only be rivaled by that of parting from an old lover. The one offers infinite vistas of possibility. The other promises the welcome end of infinite disappointment.
How true, how true.
Truth, my dear Lady Eiderdown, is merely the ransom curiosity pays to secure the release of scandal.
Of course. What wit, what wit.
My dear young man, if I were to comment on your incredible beauty, would you take the remark in the spirit in which it was meant?
Not only in the spirit, but also in the flesh. The one proverbial for its willingness, the other for its weakness.
Nigel! Nigel!
Only the weak are obliged to be willing. Strength automatically grants choice, and choice is but the sacrifice of the...
Oh, Nigel, what on earth are you doing in there?
Won't be a minute, Louise. That's the trouble, you know. All my fantasies tend to splutter to a halt when reality, i.e. Viz Louise, intrudes. And actually, when I look at my face in the shaving mirror in the mornings, I reckon it must be the picture in the attic that's getting younger. Another of Louise's regular statements about the arts concerns literature.
People are so typed by what they read. Don't you agree, Nigel?
What this means is that she only reads books that make her feel intellectually superior, and she loves finding out that other people read stuff which she would regard as...
intellectually demeaning.
Louise is never happier than when she's about 3.5 inches into a 5-inch thick tome that re-visualises the history of Bangladesh in terms of nursery rhymes set in a circus or a medieval monastery, which has been hailed by every literary critic in Hampstead as totally absorbing, and by every normal human being in the rest of the country as totally unreadable. Yuck! No prizes, incidentally, for guessing what the adult Basil Fotherington Thomas and his ghastly brood read. They are heavily into what they describe as fantasy literature. That means basically books about giants and fairies and elves and wizards and all that rubbish. Their titles may be different, but the actual stories are all identical. They are quests in which, hey, how's this for an original idea? Good is pitted against evil. You know the sort of thing I mean.
Come, my dear wife, Araminta.
Please.
Come, my equally dear sister, Arabella.
I come.
Come, my dear, dear children, Toby and Ghislaine. Oh, gather round and let me read to you from the cupbearer of Crangledoom by J.R.R. Molesworth, pub grabber and grabber whimsical books at $12.95. Chapter 33, The Gringe Nogglers of Pude. Gerd's Plume, the fleet-footed, reined his horse on the edge of the forest of Murglenewt. The stout charger, Frumflefaff, the four-legged, neighed unwillingly as the golden bit tugged at his noble mouth. He wanted to continue, to gallop on into the haunt of the Fringlebonks, to rush headlong into the last battle, to resolve once and for all the war between good and evil. But his master, trained in the long disciplines of the Craggle Master of Clab, was more cautious. Not for nothing had he kept his lonely vigil at the grotto of John Baldertine. Not for nothing had he served the long apprenticeship of the warriors of Waxnag. He had earned the title of fleet-footed by passing through the nine rings of greed. And still he could name them. Spinchmack, Rikitardi, Forglack, Plomfia, Jikarnix, Huizbaz, Okankyo, Swandi Malinatyanks, and Vum. Though mortal, he shared the strength of the Schnaddo race, and by he came across the other flobby dobs.
Yes, thank you, that's quite enough, thank you. Yes, I'm sure you know the sort of stuff I mean. Well, honestly, even my kids, Tristram and Lucinda, have grown out of rubbish like that. Oh, and those kind of books are always so long. Huge paperbacks about the size of a sliced loaf, with some muscle-bound twit holding a sword on the front. Dear, oh dear, come back, Enid Blyton, all is forgiven. And what about me? Nigel Molesworth, what do I read? What books, as Louise would put it, type me? Well, quite honestly, I find most of my literary cravings are satisfied by the evening paper. Anyway, as any fool knows, what matters in literary conversation is not what you've read, but what you appear to have read. I remember Grimes on this very subject.
Now, boys, although at the moment you're all disgusting little vermin, the time may come when you develop into civilized adult human beings. Though, seeing Molesworth and Peason in the front row, I will rephrase that. When some of you develop into civilized adult human beings. Now, that is why you are here at St. Custard's. This establishment exists for two purposes. One is to keep me in the gin, cigs and gambling habits to which I've become accustomed. Oh, that reminds me, Gillibrand.
Sir?
Take this slip to Sigismund Arbuthnot, the mad maths master, quid each way, lucky lady, in the 3:30 at Sander.
Sir?
Where was I? Yes, of course. And the second aim of your stay at St. Custard's is to give you the patina of culture. Do you know what a patina is, Peason?
Is it one of those little brass screw-headed rings that attaches a butterfly net to its handle, sir?
No, Peason, it isn't. A patina is a kind of encrustation or varnish, hence an appearance. In this case, of culture. And how do you recognise a cultured person, Molesworth?
False and cheap, sir.
What? I said cultured.
Well, sir, cultured pearls are false and cheap, sir.
Oh, shut up, boy. What I am saying is that the sign of a cultured person is wide reading. And how does such a person demonstrate his wide reading?
Well,
shut up, Molesworth. He demonstrates his wide reading by the fact that his conversation is decorated with quotations. Right. Now, does anyone have a favourite quotation?
Sir.
Yes, Fotherington Thomas, and what is your favourite quotation?
Sir, it's beauty as a primeval phenomenon which itself never makes its appearance, but the reflection of which is visible in a thousand different utterances of the creative mind and is as various as nature herself, sir.
Yes, very good, Fotherington Thomas. And just remind me who said that.
Goethe, sir. From Johann Peter Eckmann's Conversations with Goethe, sir. April 18th, 1827, sir.
Of course, just testing. Right, any other favourites?
Sir.
From someone other than Fotherington Thomas. Anyone else?
No.
Right, let's try it the other way round. I'll say a quotation and you tell me who it's from. Right, now, who said, if you can keep your head, well, all about you are losing theirs and blaming
sir,
it on
sir,
you.
Sir.
Molesworth, yes. A pleasant surprise. Who was it?
Marie Antoinette, sir.
Idiot boy, it was Kipling. Dear, let's try something easier. Right, who said, my heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky?
Sir.
Molesworth again, are you sure you know this time?
Oh, yes, sir, it's Peasy.
Right, who said it?
Fotherington Thomas, sir.
Silence! You fool, Molesworth. After school, you will write out 3 trillion times, I must not give facetious answers in class. And what is more, if you don't spell facetious right, you will have to do the whole lot again. All 3 trillion of them.
Huh. Still, the message stuck. Nowadays, I frequently decorate my conversation with quotations. It's dead easy, really, if you set your mind to it. A good rule of thumb is that nearly all quotations are by Shakespeare. And the ones that aren't are by Oscar Wilde. The only exception to this is not a drum was heard, not a funeral note, as his course of the rampart we hurried. And as any fool knows, that's by Sir John Moore. Another art that one keeps coming up against is music. I don't mind music. I mean, you know, a bit of early Elvis, and I'll bop along with the best of them. Beatles, okay, too. Rolling Stones, all that. But classical music, well, I'm afraid it leaves me rather cold. Now, I know not everyone feels the same way. Some people, mentioning no names, but yes, you guessed, Louise, like nothing better than curling up with a good ring cycle. Not me. No, I really just can't see it. Constant source of amazement to me why they keep playing all this stuff by people who've been dead for years. I can only assume it's because they're out of copyright, i.e. Viz dead cheap. Pretty annoying for the composers, it must be, particularly the ones who died in poverty. I sometimes have this fantasy, you know, of Wolfgang Amadeus Molesworth sitting up on a cloud, gazing down on the world and looking dead cheesed off.
I am most frightfully cross. Yes, I'm most extraordinarily cross. I sit up here in heaven in a state of great frustration, listening to Kirkle 7 play with no imagination. I hear my own concerti much against my intonation. What makes it really hurt is I get no remuneration. My discontent, I am a Mr. 0%, and so, no, no. Makes me sick, and I think it's pretty thick. Drives me mad, cause my music sounds so bad. Then they rearrange a waltz and turn it into awful schmaltz. When they use it for commercials, then I have a fit. Awful film scores, awful music, ugh, that makes me spit. Once they even cribbed a bit for a bloody Grumbles hit. And that bastard Peter Schaffer urges me quite a bit. Lancashire and Frau Pringle.
And then, of course, there's the theatre. No, I'm not against the theatre. I don't mind frolicking off to some mindless musical, one of those farces whose title uses the word wife instead of life, you know, the happiest years of your wife, large as wife, still wife with rolling pin, that sort of thing. First pair of drop trousers and I'm rolling in the aisle. Louise, though, sees things, him, a bit differently. She's only happy with a pair of trousers that drop in a respectable political cause. So you can guess what happens. Yes, I get dragged off to some ghastly room over a pub or a drafty bus depot to see a new work by one of our brightest new playwrights, one of those who's done everything in the theatre except entertain. These plays are always put on by a terribly dedicated group called the Frightfully Intense Marxist Theatre Company or something, and the actors and actresses all take it terribly seriously. This is a bad thing. Actors and actresses, as any fool knows, are very charming, but have absolutely nothing between their ears, and are only really worried about whether their new hairstyle makes too much of a statement and whether they should grow a moustache for the part or not. So when they start trying to understand politics, it gets dead embarrassing. Now, all these political plays tend to start in the same way. The stage is in total darkness for about half an hour, and we just hear this gibbering and whimpering. Actors love all that. A lot of them only went into the theatre for the gibbering and whimpering. Anyway, eventually, a woman in battle fatigues enters and switches on a light. Actors enjoy screaming, too. The ones who didn't go into it for the gibbering and whimpering went in for the screaming.
It's all right, Cliff. It's all right.
I'm sorry. It's the lights. I can't stand the lights being switched on. It makes me think of...
torture! You will forget. Believe me, you will forget.
Oh, the pain. Yes. Yes, I can forget the pain. The pain I can forget. But what I can't forget is...
the assault on your privacy.
No, no. It's how near I came to... renouncing Marxism. It's the secret police.
Oh.
They've come to get me again. You never get away from them. What's your names on their files?
Oh, shush. No, no, it's not the secret police. It's only the milkman leaving 3 pints and a mandarin yoghurt. If I do not answer the door, and you will go away, and I will pay my price.
Sometimes they disguise themselves as milkmen. Sometimes as milkmen.
The secret police?
No.
As milkmen? As
Ict, ict. This goes on for about another day and a half. Then finally, the stage lights go off and the audience lights come on. Oh, thank goodness for that. Quick drink and home. What do you say, Louise?
Nigel, this is only the interval.
What? Well, surely you're not thinking of staying for the second half, are you?
Of course we are, Nigel.
Well, let's at least go and have a drink.
We don't need a drink, Nigel. We've got so much to think about. This piece is so pertinent and absorbing and moving and relevant to today's issues.
Ugh. So I have to spend another 3 days of purgatory watching the second half, all the way up until the shock ending, which is... No, the action is not taking place in some underdeveloped third world country. It's taking place in...
England. Don't you understand? This is England in the 1980s.
Oh, Cliff.
Well, that has all the impact of a wet paper bag tearing. But my torture doesn't end with the play ending. Oh, no. For one thing, the whole thing's taken so long that the pubs have closed. And for another...
I really think we ought to discuss that play. Don't you agree, Nigel? I mean, it was so thought-provoking. Don't you agree, Nigel?
Oh, no. I can't stand it.
It's so much of today. And yet, at the same time, it brings home certain timeless truths. Don't you agree, Nigel? Which, while not intrinsically...
Oh, just let Louise try to take me to see another political play. Actually, now I come to think of it, that's a fairly silly thing to say, because if she decided I was going to see another, nothing short of my cremation would stop her. Even then, she'd probably take along my ashes. Oh, goodness, is that the time? Sorry, once I get going, I've got so much to say. Still, better say cheerio, let you get back to your lives, and I'll get back to mine.
Don't you agree, Nigel?
Oh, yes, Louise.
No, but really, don't you agree, Nigel? Don't you agree?
Molesworth was based on characters found in The Complete Molesworth by Geoffrey Willens and Ronald Searle, and adapted rather well, I thought, by Simon Brett from his book Molesworth Writes Again. It starred William Rushton, Clive Swift, Penelope Nice, Phil Nice, very nice too, Chrissy Roberts, Robert Harley and Bob Sinfield. Music was by Una Burnham, and a visual study aid to accompany the series is available from Grabber Visual Arts at £49.95. Molesworth was produced by Mark Robson.